"Can you give wishes now?" said the children. "Of course," said the Sand Fairy. "Didn't I give you yours a few minutes ago? You said, 'I wish you'd come out,' and I did." "Oh, please, mayn't we have another?" "Yes, but be quick about it. I'm tired of you." I dare say you have often thought what you would do if you had three wishes given you, and have despised the old man and his wife in the black pudding story, and felt certain that if you had the chance, you could think of three really useful wishes without a moment's hesitation. These children had often talked this matter over, but now the chance had suddenly come to them, they could not make up their minds. "Quick," said the Sand Fairy crossly. No one could think of anything. Only Anthea did manage to remember a private wish of her own and Jane's, which they had never told the boys. She knew the boys would not care about it, but still, it was better than nothing. "I wish we were all as beautiful as the day," she said in a great hurry.
The author of that adventure with wishes and magic is E. Nesbitt, but it could be you.
WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about the process of writing creatively. Conducting the program is children's author Jacqueline Jackson.
Today, let's think about magic. The passage that I read from E. Nesbitt refers to the black pudding story. I knew that story as a child with sausages, and it's the story of the old man and his wife who somehow get three wishes all of a sudden, and in thinking about what they want to wish, the husband, inadvertently feeling hungry, wishes for a plate of sausages, and his wife is irate that he should waste one of their three cherished wishes on sausages, and so she wishes those sausages on the end of his nose. And then, of course, both the husband and the wife realize that he can't spend the rest of his life with sausages on his nose, and since magic can't be undone by ordinary means such as pulling them off or cutting them off, they both know that the third wish has to be to wish the sausages off his nose, and there are the three beautiful wishes all gone down the drain. Maybe you think that writing a magic story should be easy, because you don't have to stick to anything. You can just make anything happen that you want to. But I think that that would make a pretty dull and boring story. For instance, suppose the story of the sausages, or the black pudding as it is in some versions, that there hadn't been a limit of three wishes. Then, so he wished for sausages. They'd be off to a bad start, but it wouldn't be a harmful start. In fact, it might even be a good way to start out. Just, you know, have your breakfast, and then let's go on with the magic. And the wife would never have wished them on the nose and so forth. Or even if she had, no harm done. Let's just get on to something else. But if all you've got is three wishes, then you have to think about it very carefully. And you may get into quite a bit of trouble. So that to make a magic story that is both fun and intriguing, I think that one of the real ways is to make your magic limited. Look at the magic stories that you know, or perhaps some that I know that you don't. Cinderella is probably the best-known fairy tale in the entire world, in hundreds of different versions. And in every version that I have read, the magic is limited. In the most common one to us, it ends at midnight. The good clothes turn back to rags, the coach turns back to the pumpkin, and so forth. The magic in many a story is sort of on again, off again. The prince is a prince at night, but he's a raven during the daytime, or something like that. And in the case of Curdy and of Cinderella and of the three wishes, the person that's using the magic knows what the limitations are when it starts out. This is a usual way. But in many stories, half the fun of the story is the person not knowing that he's dealing with a magic object. And then the interest is in discovering first that magic is going on. Strange things are happening. Then, what sort of magic is it? How is it happening? And once you discover how it's happening, you have to find out the limitations of the magic, the nature of the magic. Once you understand this, then you can begin to manage it. Up until then, it's just been running wild and getting you into all sorts of trouble. But even once you start to manage it by understanding it, you find that magic is very difficult to manage. You are forever forgetting things, limitations that you should make on your wishes, for instance. And then, often in a magic story, the last problem is how to get rid of the magic, because it is more than you can bear. It is a terrible master. One that you've probably been familiar with is the old fairy tale of the salt machine that grinds out salt, and they forget the magic words, and so it grinds out salt forever and sinks the ship that the men are carrying the salt machine on. And this is the answer to why the sea is salty, because down at the bottom there is a salt machine that has never been able to be turned off. How do you turn the magic off or get rid of it completely? We have a book that's a great favorite of ours called Marianne Dreams by Catherine Storrs. And here is a girl who is sick in bed, suffering from rheumatic fever, I think it is, and so she spends a lot of time in bed, and she discovers that she has recurring dreams. She recognizes after the first dream, when she looks into a notebook of hers, that she has dreamt about a picture that she has drawn. She drew a house, she drew a fence around it, she drew a boy's face in the window, and when she had the first dream, here she was at that same house with the fence around it, and when she goes in, there is a boy upstairs. No stairs in the house, she can't get up there, but there he is. And then she sees in her notebook that there is this picture, and she thinks that that is odd, but she adds more to it and discovers that she dreams about this house again. And this time, she has drawn stairs. She's drawn an inside of the house, and she puts in the stairs. And sure enough, when she dreams again, she finds she can go up the stairs and get to meet the boy that's upstairs. And it is a very bleak and barren house, seeing as how she hasn't drawn very much. But in her relationship with the boy, she gets very angry at him at one point. And so when she wakes up, she grabs the notebook and proceeds to blot him out and to draw somebody else in the house, since these are only her dreams. But when she goes again in her dreams to this house, she discovers that he has not been blotted out and that the girl that she has drawn in the house to play with her is not there. On waking, she ponders this strange thing. Why is it that sometimes what she draws is there and sometimes what she draws isn't there? When she had drawn the house first and then the door knocker and Mark's face at the window, she had used the pencil that had come out of great-grandmother's workbox. And when she had drawn the bars and the stones outside the garden and the hills and the road, she had again used the pencil. But when she had scribbled out Mark and drawn in Fiona, she had used one of her own ordinary crayons, and what she had drawn with that had not only proved to be delible, or whatever the opposite of indelible is, but had also not appeared in the dream. So it's the pencil, Marianne thought in surprise. It's the pencil that started it all. Well then, once she'd discovered that it was the pencil, why, she grabs it up, turns to a fresh page of her drawing book, and proceeds to fill the house with all the sorts of things that the boy in the dream needs to be comfortable. Food and bicycles and things of that sort. Well, you can see, here she is learning to handle the magic properties, and this particular book also has considerable mystical overtones of meaning, and I think you'd enjoy it very much. There is a famous writer of magic stories called E. Nesbitt that I've already mentioned, and she lived quite a while ago. Her stories take place at the turn of the century. There is a man called Edgar Eger who loved those books as a child and has quite openly said, "I am writing books in the E. Nesbitt style." And you perhaps will have more Edgar Eger books on the shelves in your school libraries than you will of E. Nesbitt. One of his that our children are very fond of is called Half Magic, and there's the same sort of problem there. The children don't realize that they are playing with magic, and once they do realize it, it's very peculiar because they get only half of what they wish for. So then they have to begin to figure out how to double their wishes so that they will get just half, and to manage this sort of magic. We have a book called The Magic Currant Bun, where the little French boy discovers that every currant in the bun, when he pinches it out and eats it, will give him a wish. And so he has to learn how to handle that magic. And one of the fun things of the story is what happens when somebody gets a hold of the magic that doesn't understand it. Pierre has been thrown in jail on account of his magic, and a rat comes up and bites his currant bun. He has had a wish in his mind at the same time, and the jail suddenly turns to Swiss cheese. The Swiss cheese, you see, is full of holes, and so Pierre is able to grab up his bun and leave through the Swiss cheese holes along with all the other prisoners in the jail. And Pierre thinks, aren't we lucky that he didn't wish that the jail was some other sort of cheese that didn't have holes in it, because then they would all have been trapped, you see, in a large block of cheese with no way to get out. So the managing of magic, the directing of your wishes, is extremely difficult. Here's another passage out of Five Children and It. Anthea is talking to the sand fairy. "Well then," she said, "everything we have wished has turned out rather horrid. I wish you would advise us. You are so old, you must be very wise." "I was always generous from a child," said the sand fairy. "I've spent the whole of my waking hours in giving, but one thing I won't give, that's advice." "You see," Anthea went on, "it's such a wonderful thing, such a splendid, glorious chance. It's so good and kind and dear of you to give us our wishes, and it seems such a pity it should all be wasted just because we are too silly to know what to wish for." "Child," said the sand fairy sleepily, "I can only advise you to think before you speak." Some of the incidents in Five Children and It that make the magic very fun are the finiteness of it, the homeliness of it. The magic carpet in one of E. Nesbitt's stories is very rug-like in that even though it is magic, it will wear out, and that the more they use the rug and the more heavy wear it gets, which their wishes always seem to involve, the more it wears out, and then you begin to get threadbare places where the magic isn't so strong, and in one place a whole leg goes through a hole, and then the magic doesn't work on that portion of the child's anatomy that is sticking through the rug, so that the magic rug can wear out. E. Nesbitt also has the homely combined with the magical and the wondrous. You might have gathered that this sand fairy is a bit nasty and ill-tempered, besides not looking at all like the usual frilly fairy that you expect. It's a rather ugly, fat, spider-like creature. In another book of hers, the phoenix is a very vain creature, and they can appeal to his vanity in granting their wishes. So that you get into all these sorts of problems when you write about magic, and those are the things that make it fun. Another property of magic is how very literal it is. You expect when you talk to people that they have some understanding of what you're trying to get at, and they will then interpret it. But the magic object believes you exactly. When King Midas said he wanted everything he touched to turn to gold, he was meaning physical objects. But then when his own daughter turns to gold, how did the magic object, you see, doesn't have the brains, doesn't have the soul to interpret these sorts of things. It should have known, the magic should have known that the wife didn't really want the sausages on her husband's nose and said, well, that's just one of those sorts of wishes. But it doesn't. It instantly gives you exactly what it is that you ask for. And if you leave the reasoning up to the magic object, which is always dangerous, you get the kind of reasoning that is not at all your kind of reasoning. Again, in E. Nesbitt, they say to the magic carpet, bring us something beautiful from your native land, from Persia. It's a Persian carpet. You'd think it might be a vase or something like that, but the reasoning of the carpet is a Persian cat. And if one Persian cat is beautiful, how much more beautiful are 199 Persian cats? So the children end up with 199 Persian cats, terrific noise going on, hungry cats. Then they have to ask the rug to bring them milk and rats for the cats to eat, and you get into these sorts of problems. You have to also take into account the loyalty of the magic object. It is loyal to you as long as you have it. But Aladdin's lamp granted the wicked uncle his wishes. It transported that castle with Aladdin's wife just as rapidly as if it had had no relationship with Aladdin and no affection for him at all. Off it went. The magic object is also committed to the truth. Mirror, mirror on the wall. It will tell honestly who is the fairest of them all. And you have to realize that it isn't going to bend things or interpret things necessarily just for you. So when we start to write our magic stories, find some particular limit to your magic. And remember that it's unfair if you have three wishes. It's unfair to wish on that first wish that you have unlimited wishes, because the nature of the fun of it is to limit your magic. Another thing I'd suggest is that you establish your magic early. Perhaps you've read a story that you think is realistic, and you're all set in your mind that this is a story that could actually happen, and then a halfway through or two-thirds of the way through, suddenly magic things begin to happen, and it's uncomfortable. It's a jip. You haven't known that the magic was going on. An example of this is a book called The River at Greenough by Lucy Boston. It's a beautifully written book, and I would recommend it highly, but I feel that it does have this flaw, that halfway through the book, you are realistic, and when the magic begins to happen, first you think, well, you know, I'm wrong. It's just the children's imagination. But then the next chapter, it absolutely has to be magic when Oscar is reduced to the size of 6 inches or something and is crawling around in the shrubbery. But meanwhile, you've been so set in the realistic part of the story that you can never accept the story. So that if your magic starts early, you decide that you can accept the magic, we are now in for a magic story, and from then on, everything follows the rules, the magic follows its own rules. So when you write your magic stories, put in with the wishes, what did you forget to say when you wished? What limitation did you forget to make? You wished for wings, but are they the sorts of wings that you can fly with? Or are they the sorts of wings that an ostrich has, so that they are just great burdens on you? Investigate double magic. How about opposite magic, where everything you wish for, you get the exact opposite? And remember that magic is a very dangerous thing, and it would be fun in these stories to see what sort of danger the magic can lead you into.
WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Teachers, if you're interested in a writing class for teachers next fall, send a note asking for more information to Jacqueline Jackson. And send your magic stories to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.